Hello, and welcome to this download from Yale University Press. In Vienna in 1935, a young man sat down to write a little history of the world for children. This is how he began.
All stories begin with once upon a time. And that's just what this story is all about. What happened once upon a time? Once you were so small that even standing on tiptoes you could barely reach your mother's hand. Do you remember? Your own history might begin like this. Once upon a time there was a small boy, or a small girl, and that small boy was me. But before that you were a baby in a cradle. You won't remember that, but you know it's true. Your father and mother were also small once, and so was your grandfather and your grandmother a much longer time ago, but you know that too. After all, we say they are old. But they too had grandfathers and grandmothers, and they too could say once upon a time. And so it goes on further and further back. Behind every once upon a time, there is always another. Have you ever tried standing between two mirrors? You should. You will see a great long line of shiny mirrors, each one smaller than the one before, stretching away into the distance, getting fainter and fainter, so that you never see the last. But even when you can't see them anymore, the mirrors still go on. They are there, and you know it.
That was Philip Pullman reading the opening of Ernst Gombrich's Little History of the World. Philip is a great admirer of the book, and we'll be hearing more from him later in this programme. Gombrich would go on to become the most widely read art historian of the 20th century. But how, as a 26-year-old, did he embark on his first book? His granddaughter, Leonie Gombrich, takes up the story.
And he had an acquaintance, Walter Neurath, who went on to found Thames and Hudson later in London, who had a job as an editor and had newly been given a series to edit for the publishing house that he worked for called Knowledge for Children. And a mutual acquaintance had sent him an English world history and as a possibility to be translated for this series. So he just gave it to my grandfather to have a look at, because his English wasn't good and my grandfather's English was good, and just to say, do you think this is worth translating for the series? And if you do, maybe you would like the job of translating it. And he had a look at that book and he thought it was just absolutely dreadful. And to illustrate how dreadful he thought it was, he said to Walter Neurath, it's so bad, I think I could have written it myself. I mean, I think I could have written a better one myself. And Neurath said, well, write me a chapter.
Gombrich passionately believed that clarity of language could allow the writer to communicate even difficult ideas to anyone. He planned his book in 39 chapters and wanted to focus on events that mattered to the lives of real people. Then he devised a working method.
Every morning he would read up a subject at home. Then he would go to the library in the afternoon and, if possible, read some text in translation, if necessary, or in the original, from the time that was contemporary to the time that he was writing about, because he wanted to really feel himself in the era. And then after supper in the evening, he would write the chapter. And he did that 6 days a week. And that's how he got it done. And then on the Sunday, and this was legend in my family for a long time, mainly because my grandmother used to talk about it, but my grandparents had met 6 years, I think, before they married, and she was a pupil of his mother's. And so on Sundays, for many years, they would go on a little expedition together, first around Vienna, around the galleries, and out into the Wienerwald, the woods around Vienna. So they would walk and they would talk, and they had mutual interests of music, of course, and art. When he had embarked on this project, as she remembers it, he said, you know, they were talking about what they'd been doing that week, and he said, well, if you don't mind, I'd like to read you something to show you what I've been doing this week. And, of course, she was interested, and he got out some scrumpled wadge of papers from his breast pocket in his incredible, illegible scrawl. And she said, well, it was just as well he offered to read it aloud because, you know, his handwriting was impossible. And he read the first tranche of the little history. And of course, and she thought it was great. I mean, it is. And in that way, he then continued throughout the 6 weeks that he had. So she heard the book in six installments read by him. And I have always thought, and this is what I was particularly keen should come out of the English translation, because of course this was in German and he wrote almost nothing of his whole oeuvre directly in German, that in English it should sound absolutely as if, as he would tell it, because that's how it comes across in the German, and that's because he did tell it.
Philip Pullman thinks Gombrich had a natural storyteller's gifts.
He always has that ability to make you wonder what's going to happen next. It's partly to do with rhythm, and this is probably, it's probably innate. It's I'm not sure it's something you can learn. The closest comparison I can find is with that odd phenomenon called swing. You can always tell a jazz player from a non-jazz player, even if they're playing the same notes, because in the jazz player's work, there'll be a subtle retarding and a subtle acceleration of the beat, which is what we call swing. And although a classically trained player can imitate that, it won't be felt in the bones and in the flesh and the muscles and the nerves and the instrument. It won't be there. Well, storytellers have this quality. Gombrich had it. He knew how to make you keep turning the pages because of the rhythm with which he put the information in front of you. And the clarity, too. He was a wonderfully clear writer. There was no virtue for him in obscurity or complexity of language for its own sake. He was a great communicator.
Pullman also admires Gombrich's confidence as a writer.
It's probably the confidence that only a young man could have, or a young writer, or a very old writer. Someone in their middle years who has had experience of how difficult these things are would quail at the task, or try and summon everything they knew and put it in calm and judicious order and write about it with an air of magisterial authority and so on, and take a year at least. But a young writer perhaps is uninhibited by the knowledge of how difficult the task is.
Writer and broadcaster Bettany Hughes is another fan of the book.
One of the great delights of reading the book is the fact that you can kind of sense Gombrich's energy and youth and verve spilling off the page. And I think, you know, it took him a very short time to write. He only wrote it in 6 weeks. And that kind of vitality almost kind of physically springs out of the ink on the page, I think. It's a very hopeful book. It's a book that imagines all sorts of possibilities for the future, even though we know that as he was writing it, he was surrounded by a very challenging and very worrying present. You know, Hitler was just about to be on the move, and I think it's one of those seminally important books because it reminds you that in a time of crisis, what you should not do is just focus your energies on how you're going to arrange yourself in order to punch the lights out of your enemy, but actually why it is that we're on this earth and what it is that as a species we're capable of. So, you know, it's a book that you can read both in times of crisis and in times of peace.
Philip Pullman also sees the little history as shaped by events that were unfolding outside the library window.
In a sense, he was writing against the world that was unfolding in Vienna, in the German-speaking countries then. He could see which way the wind was blowing, and not long after that, I think he did actually leave Austria and come to, I think he came to London. So writing this book, which is not only a history of the world, but a defence of the Enlightenment, the defence of the values of the Enlightenment, of democracy, of freedom of speech, thought and so on, was an act of courage as well. It was an act of putting down a marker, saying, these are the things I stand for, and I can see they're going to be under threat. So I'm going to leave a declaration of their value and their importance as clearly as I possibly can, so that young children and young people will have something to remember these values by if they're going to go under. And I think it's a great act of courage, really.
But 7 decades on, has the book stood the test of time? Bettany Hughes believes so.
You know, as a historian, sometimes, I must admit, when I'm reading this book, there are moments when I think, oh, recent archaeological excavations have disproved that point. But it almost doesn't matter in a way, because what Gombrich is aiming at is a deeper truth. It's not just the patina of human existence. It's the fundamental business of being a human. And I think that is one of the reasons that children love it so much. I mean, when I first read this book as an adult, I was reading it out to my children. I must admit, when I started doing that, kind of partly thinking, well, it's a slightly worthy task, you know, and this is me being a good parent, didact, and they're going to learn a lot from it. But the children absolutely loved it and begged me to carry on reading it. And I think it's because it talks about those essentials of life, you know, the need to love one another, the need to walk through the world with your eyes open, and the fact that our physical world can nourish us in so many ways, philosophically and psychologically.
The Little History was suppressed by the Nazis shortly after Gombrich left Vienna. When the book was republished decades later, Gombrich added a new 40th chapter, and rather than silently amend some of his earlier opinions, he was honest about where he had changed his mind.
I think the fact that in the final chapter he talks about the mistakes he made, about the things that he'd have done differently in his prose, it's fantastically refreshing, because it is so irritating to be presented with histories that are tablets of stone, where, you know, grand historians declare this is how it was and this is an immovable opinion. But he has the grace and the charm to admit that ideas about the world around you change. And I think it's very, very satisfying that he leaves that as an chapter at the end of the book, rather than trying to adapt his earlier work. As he is, he surely has to be one of the most delightful men on earth, and that comes across in the way that he adapts his book.
I'll leave the last word on what gives the book its lasting value to Philip Pullman. Thank you for listening.
His postscript, his final chapter, is the voice of an old man, not a young man. He was really pretty old when he died, and he'd seen a great deal, thought a great deal, written a great deal, and learned a great deal. And the postscript really is the voice of an old man talking to young children, perhaps talking to his own grandchildren, who are there with him in the photograph on the back flap. And it's the voice of wisdom. He was a very wise man, and that's a quality we don't often see these days. We don't value it very much. Well, this is a wise book, a good book, a book by a good man, a good vision. It's a wonderful book to have and to hold and to give to children too. Every school should certainly have a copy of this book. And I think every household where there are children should have a copy of this book.